Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
An historic win in Ontario.
Thank you for voting to build Ontario up. Thank you.
Kathleen Wynne and her Liberals now hold a majority government after a surprising victory in the provincial election. What caused the Liberal surge? Why did the PCs crash? And what happened to the NDP? Pollster David Coletto of Abacus Data is here to break down the numbers.
A landmark ruling from the Supreme Court finds police need to have a search warrant if they want to get information from internet service providers about subscribers' identities. What does this mean for Canadians, and what does it mean for the Harper government's new cyberbullying legislation? We're joined by privacy lawyer David Fraser.
The federal NDP has been ordered to pay back $1.17 million for what the Board of Internal Economy says is partisan mail sent out using parliamentary resources. The board says New Democrats broke the rules, but the party plans to sue. To defend the NDP's mailouts, we're joined by House Leader Peter Julian.
We also hear from a former sex worker who supports the government's new prostitution legislation. And we speak with the Canadian Medical Association about doctor-assisted suicide.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Triumphant Liberals chant the name of their leader, Kathleen Wynne, after a surprise victory in the Ontario election that has returned them to power with a majority mandate. Wynne is now the first woman to be elected premier in the province's history. Now, the party entered the long campaign as a minority, hounded by scandals, many of them from the previous premier, Dalton McGuinty, but they ended the election even stronger.
The Grits grabbed 59 seats in the legislature, an increase of 10. And so it's no surprise Wynne was all smiles as she spoke to the crowd gathered at her election headquarters in Toronto.
You did it. You voted for jobs. You voted for growth. Thank you for voting to build Ontario up. Thank you. And let me tell you, your government is ready to do exactly that. Build Ontario up. You have put your trust in us to move this province forward and to do that with integrity, and we will not take you for granted. And I will work every day to earn and keep the confidence of the people of Ontario. Thank you so much. Merci beaucoup.
But for PC leader Tim Hudak, the night ended in sorrow. His team was given a good shot at taking power, but instead the Progressive Conservatives lost 10 seats. With 27 MPPs, they remain the official opposition. But after yet another election loss to the Liberals, Hudak announced he is stepping down as leader.
I am proud of what our team has accomplished, and I am optimistic about our party's future. But I will not be leading the Ontario PC Party into the next election campaign.
For the NDP, it was a night of stagnation. Even though they triggered the election, the New Democrats didn't gain any more seats. To break down what happened in the vote, McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaks with David Coletto of Abacus Data.
Just first impressions, obviously the majority win for Kathleen Wynne and the Liberals wasn't predicted by very many people. What do you attribute it to?
I attribute it to a general sense among the public that, for one, Tim Hudak maybe was a little too risky, particularly for voters in Toronto and the greater Toronto area. And two, that at the end of the day, I think Kathleen Wynne did a pretty good job at separating herself from Dalton McGuinty's legacy. And so that allowed voters to vote for her without feeling as though they're rewarding McGuinty for the mistakes that he made.
If we try to extrapolate from this result to kind of a national picture, one thing I heard people saying last night was if you looked at the most recent Quebec, Alberta, BC, and Ontario elections, it does look like a kind of a voter appetite for a sort of safe, moderate direction rather than a kind of provocative direction. Does that ring true to you?
It does, and it's largely, I think, driven by economic perceptions. People feel as though the economy is doing okay in Ontario and in those provinces that you mentioned, but it's not doing too well, that or too poorly, that people are willing to take a risk on change. And we've seen that in multiple provincial elections. Even the 2011 federal election was very much about, staying the course, not taking a risk on what would be an unknown. And in Ontario last night, I think very clearly voters across the province gave the Liberals their fourth mandate, largely on the backs of being fearful to some extent about what Tim Hudak meant and what was a very bold plan on his part that a lot of voters just weren't willing, I think, to stomach and risk.
Hmm. Bear with me if I make what may seem like an outlandish analogy here, but when I think about election campaigns where the leader involved hitched himself to a really clear, provocative set of policies, a real platform-driven election race, I think of Stéphane Dion and now Tim Hudak. Is there likely to set in with political strategists a notion that that is just too dangerous, of course, to go down or laying out a really bold, specific policy agenda?
I think so. I think it also shows us whatever the election's about, often that thing loses, right? So in the case of this election in Ontario, it started out very much about the Liberals and whether or not the public supported their budget and whether or not people thought they deserved to be reelected. In the first few days of this campaign, the moment that Tim Hudak came out with his plan and then announced that he was going to cut 100,000 public sector jobs, the campaign shifted into one focused on his plan. So I do think that you know, this example, as well as the Green Shift and Stéphane Dion, are examples of politicians putting out a really bold idea, but then that backfiring. So, you know, for good or for bad, you know, we can debate the merits one way or the other, that maybe elections aren't about big ideas.
So making yourself a target can be a dangerous thing.
Or risking making yourself a target with a proposal that the public may not completely buy into or think is necessary, which I think is partly why Tim Hudak's plan didn't go over as well with enough people, is because he was saying that the Ontario economy is in dire straits. And while factually that might be correct, perceptually a lot of the public wasn't there, particularly in Toronto and the GTA, where we see from our tracking that perceptions of the economy were quite rosy.
Yeah, so, and we're not in a recession after all, right?
This isn't. I think, you know, if you live in Toronto and you see all the cranes and you see the congestion, you see the growth, it's hard to understand what he's talking about. And on the other hand, if you feel as though things aren't great, but they could be worse, you may not be willing to take the risk.
Could I ask you to think about the third party for a moment? I mean, some people, in fact, quite a few people I talked to, thought that the NDP and Andrea Horvath were in a position of being squeezed out and this really becoming a two-way race. It didn't transpire that way. Is there a way to think about the fortunes of the federal NDP in that context? Does it teach any lessons to them?
Well, I think, you know, Andrea Horvath was criticized by some in her party or a number of people in her party for trying to move the party to the center, much of what Jack Layton successfully did, what Tom Mulcair is trying to do. And I think, you know, it was a mixed bag. The results were a mixed bag for the provincial NDP, because while they lost a handful of seats in Toronto, which had been long held New Democrat, I would not say strongholds, but at least safe seats, they were able to pick up some seats in sort of the manufacturing areas of the province in the southwest. So, you know, on the one hand, it maybe suggests that to compete outside Toronto means you maybe have to give up some of those seats in Toronto. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think what's also interesting for the NDP, it shows that there is a willingness to support the New Democrats, that what happened in 2011 isn't necessarily a blip,
right?
But that it requires some dissatisfaction with the other parties.
Still an element of protest in an NDP vote, or at least of anxiety, right? You're voting for them because you feel bad.
Particularly in the southwest and the north, there was a lot of that. I think some people referred to them as this election's reform party.
Interesting.
That they were the vote that, you know, that the Liberals and focused on Toronto were ignoring the southwest, were ignoring the north, and so the NDP was a way to send a message to the Liberals that, you know, I mean, it's really fascinating when you look at the map that you know, Windsor is all orange now. And the areas of the southwest that were hardest hit did quite well. You know, they won Oshawa. They almost did well in – it's really – when you look at the number breakdown, they're winning in areas that have been hurt by the decline of the auto industry or manufacturing generally.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me to be a not necessarily a protest vote, but at least a vote for asking the Liberals to recognize the challenges that they're facing. But the other factor that's important to to consider if we're trying to make what's the implications for federal politics and all of this, is that I don't think that the HUDAC conservatives have tried to build the kind of relationships with, for example, new Canadian communities that the Harper conservatives have.
Mm.
And so, you know, when you look at, you know, Brampton, Mississauga, you know, Richmond Hill, they all went red yesterday provincially, but federally, they're all held by, a lot of those seats are held by the conservatives. And, you know, Jason Kenney, I guess, gets lots of credit for building those relationships. Will those last into 2015? We'll see, but I don't think you can give much credit to Tim Hudak for doing that kind of groundwork that I think the federal conservatives did.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with pollster David Coletto of Abacus Data. Now, there's also speculation that some conservative MPs may be thinking about running to replace outgoing PC leader Tim Hudak. Some of the names include Rick Dykstra and Treasury Board President Tony Clement. Transport Minister Lisa Raitt was a subject of some speculation, but her office tells us she is focused on her job and kids at the moment, but she's flattered by all the attention.
The Supreme Court of Canada has issued a landmark ruling that could have a big impact on one of the Conservative government's controversial pieces of legislation. In a unanimous decision, the country's top court has ruled that police have to have a search warrant if they want to get information from internet service providers about subscribers' identities. The case has implications for the federal government's current cyberbullying bill, setting the stage for another political clash between the Harper government and the Supreme Court.
Now, the Justice Minister's office has released a statement saying the government has always been clear any disclosure of information will be done in accordance with the law. The Supreme Court's decision has clarified the law in this area, and they'll review the decision and respect the ruling. Now, to talk more about the landmark decision, I'm joined by privacy lawyer David Fraser. What is your reaction to this ruling? What does this mean for Canadians?
I was very pleasantly surprised when the decision came down and I first saw it. It says a number of things, but it's really one thing that's very important off the bat is it's a unanimous decision from the Supreme Court. So they were all speaking with one voice, which makes it an even more compelling and stronger decision. And they came down very strongly in saying that part of our right to privacy, which is rooted in the right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure in the Charter, is the right to be anonymous. And I think this is a very important finding in light of the Internet, and it comes out of the Internet. When you and I, in the offline world, for example, and you're looking for information, you can go into a library and you can look at things, and nobody's going to record your name, and there's not some log kept. But online, you expose your Internet protocol address, your IP address, to all and sundry, every computer server you connect to, for example. And this court has recognized that you and I have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the things that we do online. Now, it's not absolute. None of these rights are absolute. But the court very strongly said that the police can't require, the police can't even ask for this information from an Internet service provider without a warrant. And the Internet service provider can't hand it over without it being a search that engages the Charter. And so, as I said, it's not absolute. So certainly the police are free to go to a judge or a justice of the peace and convince them that the public interest in investigating a crime overrides your individual privacy interest in that information.
With this ruling in place, would there be any situation where their information is still open to access for law enforcement officials without a warrant?
Certainly, there always is, and there always has been, and I expect there always will continue to be, the ability for law enforcement to require somebody to hand over information in what's called exigent circumstances. So in the event of an emergency, a bomb threat where the clock is ticking, or a kidnapping where time is of the essence and there's no time to get a warrant, that will continue. But certainly that's subject to some judicial supervision after the fact. But certainly, and I hope and I expect that this closes the door on routine, unaccountable disclosures of customer information from internet service providers, at least in this context.
And so what does that mean, not just for the police, but for governments?
One thing that we need to keep in mind, so this is a specific kind of request. So these are PIPEDA requests. And we saw the transparency report that Rogers produced this past week that showed 700 and some odd of these requests that they complied with in the last year, in 2012, 2013, which suggests to me these sorts of requests, the specific type of request is made probably between 1,000 and 5,000 times a year in Canada. And so now it is absolutely clear that they can't make these requests, that the police can't make these requests, and telcos can't provide that information unless there's a warrant. And so certainly this will require law enforcement agencies to rethink the sequence in which they do these investigations. It's not going to stop them in their tracks, but it's going to make them go and get a production order at a certain stage, which they can get in the course of legitimate investigations. I think it also certainly, the conclusion of this case is complete opposite of the position that law enforcement and the current government have put forward with respect to your expectation of privacy online. And so I think that certainly they should, and the government should, rethink some of their basic provisions, their basic thinking on online privacy, particularly as we have in front of us Bill C-13 and S-4. I'm not sure this ruling makes any of those immediately unconstitutional, although some experts in this area have suggested that that is the case. But certainly I think they should take the opportunity over the summer, when Parliament rises, to carefully study this decision and think about what do they need to do to make Bill C-13 and S-4 comply with and come into line with the charter as it's now been interpreted by the Supreme Court of Canada.
Yeah, and that was going to be my next question on Bill C-13. I mean, this bill has received a lot of attention because of the surveillance aspects that are in C-13. So on the face value of it, as you were saying there, you're not too sure whether this now means that the bill would be in contravention with a ruling from the Supreme Court?
I don't think so. So just off the bat, so Bill C-13 doesn't have the offensive things that Bill C-30 had in it before it that would have allowed law enforcement officers to ask ISPs for customer name and address information without a warrant and would have required those ISPs to hand over that information. So that's not in Bill C-13. All of the new police powers, other than a preservation demand, all require some level of judicial authorization. So the where it bears close scrutiny is what is the threshold. So for example, in C-13 is something called a production order for transmission data, which relates to metadata, which an IP address is metadata. As it's currently written in the bill, a police officer can get that and a judge can order it if there are reasonable grounds to suspect a crime has been committed. Well, that's a pretty low threshold. That's not reasonable or probable grounds to believe a crime has been committed. That's just a police officer's spider sense.
So does this raise the bar then as to what's necessary to be able to access that IP address or that metadata?
I believe it should. But the Supreme Court of Canada case, Supreme Court of Canada decision from today doesn't come right out and say that. And so it doesn't say that explicitly. So we're drawing some inferences from it. Certainly, Bill C-13, if it were passed, is vulnerable to a charter challenge, and I expect it will be. If they were to improve it, if they were to raise the bar on these privacy issues, it would be more likely to be defensible and would survive such a challenge. But I'm not sure it's a slam dunk in either direction.
That was privacy lawyer David Fraser.
Coming up, the NDP is ordered to pay back $1.17 million for improper mailings. We hear from a former sex worker who supports the government's new prostitution legislation, and we discuss doctor-assisted suicide with the Canadian Medical Association.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, we hear from a former prostitute supporting the government's new laws on prostitution. We speak about doctor-assisted suicide with the Canadian Medical Association, and we take a look at all the action this week in the House of Commons.
But first, the New Democrats have been slapped with a big bill from the Board of Internal Economy. The secretive board that controls the finances of the House of Commons has decided the NDP broke the rules when sending out 2 million pieces of mail that were partisan in nature. The board spokesperson, Government Whip John Duncan, breaks down the costs.
$1.17 million. Of this amount, about $36,000 is owing to the House, and $1.13 million is associated with the use of franking privileges.
Franking is the free postage that Canada Post gives to MPs, as long as it's for their work as a member of Parliament and not for the work of a political party.
The NDP broke the rules because the mailings used the party's website, and some of them even directed people how to vote in upcoming by-elections. Both are against the bylaws, according to the board. The story became a point of attack in question period as the Prime Minister and his government took aim at the opposition.
But once again, Mr. Speaker, none of this excuses the NDP misusing public funds for partisan.
But the NDP claims it always followed the rules and the party is refusing to comply, threatening a legal challenge if the government or Canada Post tries to get the money back.
To defend his party, I'm joined now by NDP House Leader Peter Julian.
So, Peter, as I understand things, the sort of two complaints about the mailouts for the NDP are the mentions of the website, the party website specifically, and the sort of electoral issues or implications within those mailouts. So first of all, in those, I mean, do you guys disagree with that criteria first and foremost?
Well, we follow the rules, and the rules are very clear about what's permitted in mailouts. Now, what we're saying is, if what the Conservatives and Liberals are saying is that you can't have a link to your website, and why are Liberal and Conservative mailers going out with links, in the Conservative case, the very controversial Sims database, it's been cited in court documents around the robocall scandal, and why are Liberals putting out links to their party website? If that's the case, if they're saying that that was wrong, then why are they doing it, and why won't they allow either the House administration to look at Conservative and Liberal mailings, because the secretive partisan BOIE, Board of Internal Economy, is refusing to give the House administration the ability to actually assess the Liberal and Conservative mailings. And why not, if they think there's a problem with the mailing, bring in an impartial arbitrator who can evaluate this, which we believe should be the Auditor General. Bring the Auditor General in to evaluate House resources and the Parliament of Canada. And we've been trying for a year to get the Auditor General in, and Conservatives and Liberals have been stonewalling, which shows that it's nothing more than a partisan witch hunt.
But isn't there, I mean, my understanding of it is that there's a House administration report that backs up sort of the concerns about your mail. And in terms of the other mail and the Conservatives and Liberal mail, it seems to me that there's some ambiguity there, you know, so the Conservative mail, there was a website for the Conservative caucus, and a Liberal flyer that went out with liberal.ca may have predated some sort of rule change. Like, are you guys completely confident that you are completely in the right on what you've done?
We're completely confident that we're in the right. We also are confident that if you subject the Conservative and Liberal mailers to the same criteria, that what you'll see is a similar concern around the partisan nature. Now, the mailers that we have from the Conservatives that attack personally in a very vicious way Tom Mulcair are very clearly partisan. The mailers that attack viciously and NDP MPs like Craig Scott from the Liberal Party clearly are partisan. What the Conservatives and Liberals are saying is, hey, we decide what's partisan and what's not. We're going to decide that unilaterally because we're the old parties and what we say goes. What we're saying is subject it to a common test. Have the House administration actually look at Conservative and Liberal mailings, which the Board of Internal Economy has absolutely refused because they know full well that there'll be real criticism for the partisan nature, particularly of the Conservative and Liberal mailers, and bring in the Auditor General. The Auditor General has requested jurisdiction over the Parliament of Canada, and yet Conservatives and Liberals are stonewalling and refusing to let the Auditor General in. You have to ask the question, what are they trying to hide? What are the decisions in the secret of BOIE that Conservatives and Liberals don't want the Canadian public to know about and don't want taxpayers to know about?
So that maybe gets to the larger issue here of MP mail, and we've sort of been over this before with 10%ers and now this controversy. One reaction might be to say, why should MPs have any free mailing privileges whatsoever? You know, do we need to go that far? Do we need to completely blow up the system that we have? Do we need to completely reassess the fact that you guys are allowed to send mail free if you're going to send stuff out that's attacking other parties?
Well, as I say, the attacking seems to be taking place from Liberals and Conservatives. I think we need common rules. I think the Auditor General is best placed to look at this because the Auditor General is the one who will be able to say, do we get value for money or not? I mean, the mailing privileges are very clear in the Canada Post Act, and they are universal. They're not subject to regulation except for the householders that are sent to an individual riding, which is why Lisa Raitt and her attempt to try to influence Canada Post and to put pressure on Canada Post to continue the Conservative witch hunt is incredibly inappropriate. This from a minister who's always said there's nothing she can do about Canada Post refusing to deliver and shutting down delivery to 5 million households across this country. She said, no, we can't. It's an arm's length organization. But when it's a Conservative witch hunt, all of a sudden she puts pressure on Canada Post to do the Conservative Party bidding. That's incredibly inappropriate. And so let's have The best way to resolve this is have the Auditor General come in.
But is there any defense for mailing privileges in general? I mean, you know, if these mailouts are going to be used to sort of promote MPs' own causes or promote MPs' sort of partisan efforts in that, you know, why should the public even be paying for those in the first place?
Well, I know that my constituents appreciate the updates. I've seen it in the social media as well in the last few days. I've had some of my constituents weigh in on the material I send out, which talks about the work that I'm doing in Ottawa, community outreach that I'm doing as well, the bills I'm supporting, the bills I'm not supporting, all those kinds of things. People appreciate that information from their MP. I think there is also a case to be made. For example, as a former energy critic, I send information on clean energy across the country, and I think that's something that a lot of people who are interested in clean energy want to hear about. So there's certainly a case to be made of doing mailings right across the country.
That's NDP House Leader Peter Julian speaking about the order for the New Democrats to pay back $1.17 million for improper mailings.
Last week, we had Justice Minister Peter McKay on the show talking about his new anti-prostitution legislation. McKay aims to make buying sex illegal in all cases, but selling sex under his proposed law would only be illegal if it was done in a place where children might be around. Current sex workers are angry, saying the new laws would make their lives more dangerous, but not all who have been involved in the sex trade are against the bill. Katarina McLeod, a former prostitute, was on Parliament Hill this week to support Bill C-36 and speak about her own experience.
I had already been molested and raped as a child from the age of 5, so I was very, abuse wasn't new to me. So these were things that were instilled into me before ever entering the sex trade, and that's what a lot of women suffer of. And that's what happens is you lose your worth somewhere along the line. When you are abused as a child, you feel like this is what men do. I spent 15 years in the sex trade, and it's a very... There's a pattern for most women as you get in and all of a sudden you're seeing all this money and you're like, your head's swelling up and you're like, oh my gosh, all these men are paying attention to me. Because really that's what we're looking for when we are young and feel like we have nothing. We're looking for that father figure. We're looking for attention. We're looking for love. But that doesn't last very long because the shame starts to kick in and you realize what you're doing is wrong, but now you're addicted because of the money. So what happens is you need to numb yourself. In numbing yourself, you start to take drugs and you become an addict and you get trapped. And after you spend more time in the sex trade, you feel that there is nothing that you are good for and this is the only thing that you can do. I mean, what would I have put on my resume? Ex-prostitute, it wouldn't have worked. It was actually a customer who helped me get out of the industry, but by getting me out of the industry, I became his own sexual prostitute.
One of the most prominent advocates of the new Get Tough on Johns approach is Conservative MP Joy Smith of Winnipeg. She speaks with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes about the new legislation, a bill she was influential in shaping.
Can I just start by asking, how did you get interested in this issue in the first place? You've made quite a crusade around it. How did it become something that gripped you?
Well, my son was in the Integrated Child Exploitation Unit. That's a specialized unit that we're going after predators that prey on children over the internet.
Sorry, that's the unit of what?
This integrated unit came from RCMP and other police officers, and he worked and rescued a lot of victims with that unit. But then he continued on. He was so moved by it. His hair turned gray literally overnight. And I started asking as a mom, what's going on here? My background is, you know, I have a master's in education and math and science and was starting my PhD, and I had no intention of doing this. But then I started working with the victims when I found out from my son what was going on. It touched my heart so deeply that I've never looked back.
Many people around Parliament Hill first heard about the Nordic model, the idea of criminalizing Johns but not criminalizing prostitutes, from you and some of the advocacy work you've done. Is the bill that we have now in front of the House, is it close enough to the Nordic model for your liking?
I love the bill. It has a nice balance. It's a made-in-Canada model, and I think it's designed for Canada, for what's really happening in our country. I think we've changed the paradigm. The paradigm used to be under nuisance laws for these women, as you know, under even a different section of the criminal code. But I'm so pleased that now it shows that it goes after the pimps and the Johns big time. It cuts off the market. And number two, it rehabilitates the victims, the prostitutes, the trafficked girls. And the average age of entry into prostitution is between 14 and 16 years in our country right now. These are just children.
This question about the bill does leave a criminal charge for women who are, well, and men too, mm-hmm. I guess, who are engaging in prostitution, selling sex, where a minor might be present. And there are people who are also very in favor of the Nordic model who've looked at that aspect of it and said, well, that still leaves open the possibility of criminal charges in quite a few cases. That doesn't bother you?
The only place really is going to be defined in committee. It's not defined succinctly now. And I think that's one issue that will be hashed out at committee. It's in front of schools during daylight. And in all the 14 years I've worked with victims, I've never seen that happen.
So you'd like to see it, just to be clear, you'd like to see it clarified. So we're talking about near schools, not just generally in public.
Yeah, because that's what I'm hearing too, so that's what committee work is for.
Okay. You had three former prostitutes up today in your news conference on the Hill, and it seemed to me that all of them, or at least two of them, talked about early abuse, horrific, heart-rending stuff about having been abused at a very early age. And it struck me as I listened to them that isn't a lot of the issue here psychiatric services and youth family services, the sorts of things that intervene early and prevent people from being scarred and left in a place where they're vulnerable to being pulled into the sex trade? That seems to me to be a big part of the puzzle. Do you agree with that?
I think that's a very insightful comment, because a lot of people that do act are lured, are sexually abused very young, and so they see this as normal. But there's a huge proportion of teenage girls who came from very good families. They've never been sexually abused, but they're lured by someone they trust. So it can be a boyfriend, it can be a relative.
The reality is that no one thinks that prostitution is going to disappear from Canadian cities and towns overnight, or probably any time. Is there anything in this bill that you think actually will make it safer for women who are selling sex? I mean, I accept entirely the premise that the best thing to do would be to eliminate it as much as possible, criminalize people who are exploiting people. I don't think those points can be seriously argued with. But in terms of thinking about the lives of women who are in that trap, what about this bill makes life safer for them? That was a preoccupation of the Supreme Court ruling last year.
Yes. Number one, we're making the buying of sex illegal, so we're targeting the Johns. It makes it safer when the guys are afraid to buy sex. There's less of them doing it. The next thing is the programming that's going in. With the programming, they have a way out. It makes it safer for them, because I've met lots of them, the majority of them. In fact, I've never heard of anyone who wanted to stay in it in 14 years. So I don't know where all these other stories are coming from. It makes it safer because they can go into something else, and they're supported. They're looked at in a compassionate way, not as those bad girls luring men out there. Because now we're seeing the backstory of how they got there. So it's a very compassionate bill, and the paradigm is changing. That's very important.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes speaking with Conservative MP Joy Smith about new prostitution legislation.
Coming up, we'll talk about the looming debate on doctor-assisted suicide, and we'll let you know about all the action this week in the House of Commons. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
This week, the Canadian Medical Association released its report on end-of-life care following a series of town hall meetings across the country that were hosted by Maclean's Magazine. The CMA found a great deficiency in palliative care. That's the field of health care that is focused on relieving the pain of terminally ill patients. It also touches on euthanasia and doctor-assisted suicide, with the CMA urging all federal and provincial politicians to once again open the discussion on these controversial topics. To talk more about the CMA's findings, Dr. Louis Francis Scuddy, the president of the Canadian Medical Association, joins me by phone from Edmonton.
My pleasure.
We'll talk a little bit more about the important issue of palliative care in a few moments, but first we wanted to touch on the issue of doctor-assisted death. Now, that was one of the issues that your report touched on, and I'm sure you had many discussions on this throughout your town halls with Maclean's Magazine across the country. What did you find?
Well, it's something that Canadians are not afraid to talk about. They actually wanted to talk about it. And what we found is that there's some people that are strongly in favor of it, and there's some people that are strongly opposed to it. And the same thing exists within our profession. Physicians are no different than any other member of society, and so some are for, some are against. But people were appreciative of the fact that we talked about it and that their views were listened to in a respectful manner.
And how is that divide? I mean, is it pretty much a 50-50 divide when you look at this issue?
Well, you know, it's very hard to know if it's 50-50 or 60-40 or 80-20. And the reason is there's so much confusion around the terminology. So depending on how you ask the question, people may interpret that question differently. So I'm not so concerned about the numbers. I'm more concerned about making sure that we have a discussion about it and put it on the table and don't try and ignore it. It's a reality of life. Some people want to talk about it, some don't. At the end of the day, very few patients would actually qualify for it. So, you know, when you take a look at in Switzerland, Dignitas, that's the company that actually does euthanasia. They say they have a lot of people that make inquiries, fewer make applications, and very few actually go through with it. So people want to have a sense of control that that's an option. How many people would actually avail themselves of that option remains to be seen.
One argument that always comes up in the discussion about physician-assisted death is the slippery slope argument. Is that something you heard as well?
Right, and that's an important one because countries that actually allow euthanasia now are starting to see evidence of that. And we always have to keep in mind the most vulnerable and disabled within our society have to be protected. So if the law says that this option will be available to patients, then, you know, physicians will evolve. But no physician will ever be forced to participate if they don't believe in it.
What kind of restrictions are Canadians looking for if doctor-assisted death is legalized?
Well, they're concerned, for example, with some of the cases that we've seen in Holland where, you know, an individual underwent a sex change that didn't go well. They felt their life wasn't worth living, asked to be euthanized. A person with severe depression felt life wasn't worth living, asked to be euthanized. I mean, usually when you talk about euthanasia, you're talking about neuromuscular, you know, progressive, debilitating diseases that, you know, whose course has already been predetermined. But now what we're starting to see it is in kids, seeing it with mental illness. And, you know, as a society, it's up to society to have that debate and to physicians follow the lead of what society is saying. We can't be the ones that say, you know, yes, no, this is going to be decided by, you know, the politicians or the Supreme Court. And we will avail ourselves to, you know, doing what's in the best interest of patients and protecting those that are vulnerable.
What are you calling on the federal government to do around physician-assisted death? What do you want to see from them as well as provincial governments?
Well, it'll be interesting to see the dynamics between the feds and Quebec as Quebec starts working through Bill 52 and trying to enact it. Initial indications are that the federal government is saying that, you know, this is a criminal issue. It's not a medical issue and you've exceeded your, you know, jurisdiction. So we'll see how that debate plays out. We'll see how the Supreme Court case in October, the Carter case, plays out. We'll see how Member of Parliament Stephen Fletcher's two bills around physician-assisted death play out as well. So I had mentioned earlier at the press conference that a perfect storm is in front of us, and we're sailing into it right now, and I don't know exactly how we're going to come out of it. Right now, the CMA's official stand is that physician-assisted suicide is illegal, and, you know, we don't support it.
The Justice Minister says he doesn't want to reopen this debate at all. What do you think of the Justice Minister's response to this whole thing?
I think that's a pretty bold statement, given the fact that our report and others are showing that Canadians want to talk about this. So that might be the Minister's current stand, but, you know, if this is going to cost votes, I'm sure that he may revisit it, but that's up to him.
Let's move on to palliative care now. What is the current situation? Is it bad? Are we not getting enough of this kind of care right now?
Only about, you know, 15 to 30% of Canadians have access to some sort of palliative care. The majority of Canadians do not have access to palliative care, and that's an embarrassment for a country as rich and diverse as ours. You know, death is as guaranteed as life, and yet our healthcare system has been slow to respond to the growing demand for better end-of-life care. And I suspect that baby boomers will not put up with what they're seeing their parents go through. So I think it's going to be the baby boomers that demand a national palliative care strategy that focuses on end-of-life issues.
So is this a funding issue? Because to my understanding, it's not all taken care of by the province, this kind of care. And that's a burden on a lot of families. So is it a question of more funding being allocated towards palliative care?
There may be a few upfront costs, but those upfront costs, as I said, will bring efficiency to the patient, not calling for an ambulance at a cost of $1,000, not visiting an emergency department at a cost of probably $2,000, $3,000, not tying up an acute care bed at a cost of, you know, $5,000, $6,000, as opposed to having, you know, a palliative care nurse or social worker visit the home and take care of those needs right in the home environment. So it's cheaper at the end of the day. There may be some upfront costs, but it's dollars well spent, given the fact that unless somebody's figured something differently, we're all going to die. And as boomers are growing, you know, these deaths are just going to appear in numbers that we've never seen before.
That's Dr. Louis Francescotti, the president of the Canadian Medical Association, speaking about palliative care and doctor-assisted death. For more information on end-of-life care, go to the CMA's website or head to mcleans.ca.
And now it's time for our question period and review. We're joined by the host of QP Live on mcleans.ca, Nick Taylor-Vasey, who takes a look back at all the action this week on the floor of the House of Commons.
This week, the NDP cast about for something to befuddle the government benches as June wore on in the House of Commons. They cranked up the rhetoric on a Tory prostitution bill dismissed by sex workers. They attacked the Tory economic record. They asked just how many Syrian refugees have arrived in Canada. Fair questions all, but nothing that knocked conservatives off their well-practiced lines. QP is no longer the single-issue affair it once was and where the NDP so thrived. On Monday, NDP Deputy Leader Megan Leslie hardened her language on Justice Minister Peter McKay's sex work bill.
People are realizing that the Conservative government's new legislation on sex workers is deeply flawed and it's likely unconstitutional. Instead of reducing the risk that women face, the bill risks entrenching extremely problematic aspects of the old legislation. So will the government do the sensible thing? And will they submit this to the Supreme Court?
Hear, hear.
Much as the NDP used stronger language on prostitution than last week, the party didn't push the issue this week. On Tuesday, with the shooting deaths of three Moncton Mounties fresh in the minds of parliamentarians, Tory MP Rob Clark silenced a fractious House with a tribute to the fallen officers.
Three RCMP officers were killed and two others were wounded in Moncton. Having personally experienced the loss of two members of the RCMP at Spearwood Detachment, I have seen a community's pain. This tragic loss has shown the true resiliency of the people of Moncton and New Brunswick.
Harper took every chance he had on Thursday to bask in a bad news day for the NDP. Mulcair asked how many Syrian refugees had arrived in Canada since the feds announced they'd accept those fleeing civil war. Harper spent most of his time talking about the official opposition.
Canada has been one of the biggest contributors to refugee assistance around the world. But, Mr. Speaker, once again, the real question the Canadians are asking is when the NDP is going to return public money that it took
that it took completely illicitly to use on partisan mailing and partisan offices under the guise of parliamentary spending. The NDP knows from top to bottom that this was inappropriate and incorrect and fraudulent and should do the right thing.
Any day now, Parliament will recess for the summer. Everyone could use the time away. Any day now.
Once again, with Question Period in Review, that's Nick Taylor-Vasey, host of QP Live on Macleans.ca. That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.